To access everything Autish for all your Autish needs, please access autish.card.co, card spelled as C-A-R-R-D. This provides my blog, podcast, YouTube, and social media.
My name is Jake Sanson, and I'm a motorsport commentator and sports television presenter.
It's great having you here in this podcast. I mean, it's just what you do is just so much that you do. It's just, it's mind-blowing. It's really cool.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And what's more surprising as well is that you're autistic as well. So I'd like to hear more on your autism story as well as your motorsport commentator story. But first we can start on autism stuff. So, yeah.
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? It's quite funny. A lot of people will kind of look at me, and if I mention to them that I'm autistic, people will go, really? They're just so surprised. But because I think it's unheard of for somebody to be in such an affluent position, or certainly, you know, the sort of the public eye sort of position, who has a handle on things and also be autistic. So it is a bit unusual, I guess. But I was diagnosed back in 1990, and I was born in Lewisham and raised in the initial years in Catford in London. We lived in a fairly reasonably hectic and built up area. And it was very clear from a young age, my mother tells me, that I wasn't really verbal in any sort of cognitive manner. I kind of made up my own language, which she always affectionately referred to as Jakenese. It was kind of, it didn't really make any sense to anybody but me. And this was kind of the way that we developed until I was about four. And it was only when I was about 4 years old that I started to make declarations of what I wanted correctly. So I think, you know, I'd been muttering in my own language and doing my own thing. And, you know, my mother picked me up and, you know, to get me ready for bed. And I just said, water. And that was the first time pretty much that I had made any indication using English words, proper English words, of something that I wanted. So it was clear that I could improve. I could better myself. But I was diagnosed in 1990, obviously, as I said, and it was at a time when autism really was a different landscape back then to what it is now. What we know 32 years on is completely obsolete compared to what we know now. Everything has changed. It's such a different condition, and we know more about the sort of the characteristics of autism than we have ever known. It's very much something that I am sort of dealing with on a day-to-day. And because I'm high functioning as an autistic, I sort of learned to build coping mechanisms to just get on with it. And people thought me a bit odd and a bit strange, but nobody really made any particular concessions for me being autistic, because I didn't look like an autistic. I didn't speak like an autistic. And people's opinions of an autistic person was someone that was either quiet and completely non-communicative or non-verbal, or, you know, didn't make eye contact with anybody, or, you know, I didn't really follow any of the particular norms. And back then, all we really had were things like the movie The Boy Who Could Fly, you know, as a sort of an indication as to what an autistic person was. So it's interesting. I've kind of grown up as a high-functioning autistic, not really knowing how to get on with it, because there wasn't really a massive implementation of support. It just kind of, you know, you either had support from the state if you were definitely, you know, non-verbal or non-communicative, or you just learned to get on with it. And I was definitely the latter.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I can relate to that to an extent. I didn't get diagnosed till I was an adult. I was late diagnosed. I did get like other labels when I was like a child, like special needs, learning difficulties, and I did get support and such. And I had to find coping mechanisms as well as I got older, because I didn't get... I did get support like at school and stuff, but like outside of that, it was just... okay, let's try this way, let's try that way. And when I got diagnosed, it was like everything made sense.
I mean, it was funny because I lived in a house with two autistics, myself and my brother, and we're at complete opposite ends of the scale. So I'm very high functioning. My brother is very, I don't want to use the term low functioning, but you can certainly tell of the two of us, which one is autistic. If you were to put us both in the room, you would say that my brother is autistic and I'm okay, which is unusual because, you know, we both are. But, you know, you can tell with him, he very much speaks in his own language. He communicates in his own world. Everything he says is still English, but, you know, the things that he says are echoed from television shows and movies that he watches. And, you know, the quotes that he says will match his mood or match what he's interested in at that time. So if he's stressed, he will pick up dialogue from a movie where somebody is stressed. If he's happy, he'll take quotes from movies and TV shows where they're expressing happiness. And it's the same with anger, with fear, with, you know, irritation. He's very, very good at feeling emotion, but he doesn't really discuss things. We can't have a conversation. He can ask for things, and that's about the extent. But yeah, it's very, very different when you live in that and you grow up around that, you know, 24/7, and then you have to deal with it in a very different fashion for your own needs. And I didn't really know how much I needed assistance with my autism, really, until about the age of 26, 27. And it was quite a shock when I kind of realized to myself, oh man, I really do need help with this stuff, actually.
I totally relate. I was a similar age when I realized that as well. I was at university. And I was like, I actually really do need the extra support. Because I was stubborn for a while, because I grew up in a household being told left, right and centre, you have this, you have that. And some of it was truth and some of it wasn't. So I'm like, I don't know what to believe. And at one point I rebelled and was just like, I'm fine. But then I realised the hard way, I'm not fine, I do need support. And nowadays I actually embrace it and live with what I have. And I'm glad how my mind works in that. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the difficult thing, isn't it, with it, is accepting that you need help. I think that's the toughest thing to admit.
Definitely. Absolutely. It's a huge step. You've been commentating on motorsports for like since 2011, and you've done so, so much, and also TV presenting and all that as well. Could you tell us your journey on that? Because it's just, I've seen like your reels and stuff, and I just, it's so much, it's really cool.
So it's weird, you know, I still don't really believe it's happening sometimes. It's weird because when you get to a certain point, I think especially when you have autism as well, you don't really believe everything that's going on around you, especially if it's something that's, you know, too good to be true.
Agreed.
But when I started 2011, I was working as a youth worker on the streets of Wrexham and Liverpool, and I desperately needed a little bit of a boost. I needed more income, but I needed something that was going to supplement the youth work without being too much of a strain on my time or education or training. And would just add a bit more income. And the only thing I knew anything about without having to do anything major was racing cars. That was it. So I had to go and get a job with something that A, I had a passion for, and B, that I could just walk in and get a job. And my local indoor karting circuit just happened to have some vacancies. So I went in and offered my services, and I started doing daily grind jobs. So I was, you know, sweeping floors, cleaning and polishing helmets, washing race suits. You know, if there were kids' parties, you would clean up after that, these sorts of things. And after about sort of 3 months or so in the job, you know, we had a Saturday corporate Grand Prix where everybody would come in and race each other. And it became a sort of a regular community type thing. And I said to them, the managers, I said, we should have a commentator for this. It would really add to the environment, add to the atmosphere. I thought, well, that sounds like an interesting idea, Jake. Do you know anyone who could do that? And I said, yes, me. And so I just literally just created the opportunity for myself. And I don't know if they're ever going to listen to this, the boys, but they said, do you have any experience of doing this? And I said, oh, yes, I used to do it for university and college radio, which was a pathetic maudlin lie, ladies and gentlemen. I completely lied my way in. You have to. Sometimes you just have to get ahead. You have to showcase. Yeah, I've done it before. We did it once or twice, and they loved it. And so did the punters, which was the main thing. And that became the regular on my Saturdays. I was just indulging my own enjoyment, basically. You know, I was having a relatively good time at that point. And yeah, on Saturdays, I just got to commentate on racing. It was just a nice little side thing to what I was doing. It wasn't until Christmas came along that year when we had the North Shropshire Autographs Club came in and had their Christmas party with us. And they were so impressed that the chairman, Ernie Ashley, he came up and said, what are you doing next year? I said, well, this is what I'm going to be doing. And they said, well, we want you to come and commentate for us. And that was enough of a confidence booster, that recognition, to kind of think, oh, well, maybe someone else might like this as well. So I started to look around. And at this point, I was not confident at all. I just had a passion for commentating. That's all I had. And I wanted to stay within my local area. I didn't want to travel too much because I just wanted to start small. So I went to Alton Park every week I could, which was 10 miles from my house. It's a great race circuit up in Cheshire. And started to look for commentary opportunities in and around that sort of catch area. So that led me to stock car racing and banger racing. And that was with a promoter called Star Tracks. And at the time they had meetings in Manchester, in Stoke, in Sheffield, and in Coventry. And I did an audition. I did one race during the weekend and everybody looked dumbfounded that this, you know, crazy young lad was just so full of energy, and they had no idea where he had been hiding all this time. And I was brought in for the season. And at the same time, I ended up, you know, basically just emailing anyone in the area who had something to do with motor racing. I got a chance at Alton Park to replace a television presenter who was ill, just because I happened to be at the race circuit and seemed to know what I was talking about. That led to a job in the pit lane in Brick Car, which is a form of British sports car racing, which I then did for the next 2 years. And I got put on to a chap called Alan Taddeye, who is a filmer, director, and broadcaster of karting events. So I started doing a couple of bits and pieces with him, presenting initially, and then he heard that I could commentate. I did one meeting for him, and that was it as far as he was concerned. He said, right, well, I'm going to let you take the lead on commentary. And I've been commentating with him now. I've just finished my 11th year with him. So, and then by the end of that year, I had enough footage to put a showreel together. I sent it to every television company I know, and only one came back, and that was Eurosport. They invited me to their offices in London. I went down, and after a 15-minute meeting, they signed me up. And the rest is history. I literally went from my sofa to a Eurosport commentator in about a year.
That's amazing.
And I still don't know how I did that. And I've never been represented by an agent. Everything I've done has been my own sweat, my own toil, looking for opportunities and looking for work and getting my name out there. And I look back at the end of 2022, I've been the voice of European and World Karting Championships for the last 5 years. I did one Formula One Grand Prix, which was the British Grand Prix in 2019. I've done the Le Mans 24 Hours twice, which is the biggest race on the planet if you're into motor racing. It is just the biggest deal. I've done Indy cars, bikes, trucks, carts, lawnmowers, you name it, I have done it all. And it's amazing to think that I've literally done that on passion and sheer determination for the last 11 years. I have no idea what's coming next, but I quite like that because it keeps you on your toes, it keeps you fresh, and it keeps you motivated. So yeah, it's just been an amazing journey.
That's just amazing. It's kind of like that Night in the Museum quote. It's like, I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow. And then the guy who's played by Robin Williams goes, how exciting. It's basically
how
that.
How exciting, yeah. It's one of my favourite lines in any movie. Yeah, I absolutely adore that line.
It's so relatable, especially how you've shown so much passion to your craft and being at the right place at the right time, and just the passion that you show, all the work you've done, and you've reached to that point. It's just so amazing. I hope it inspires a lot of other autistic folks out there. It inspires me because I do a lot of projects myself. I do quite a few things. I do video editing for a few folks sometimes as well. So, well, graphic design, I guess. So it's just, I like to keep myself busy, and but also do passion and challenge myself. And it's
absolutely,
it seems like you're doing that every time you do your...
Yeah, that's a good assessment of it. I mean, I am one of those sorts of people. I cannot abide being a Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 kind of office person. I can't get motivated by that kind of thing. And I've tried so many different jobs. Someone actually asked me, you know, what jobs have you done in the past? And I sit back and think about it before I even came into sports commentary and journalism. I mean, it's insane, the list. I mean, I've done everything from office temp to paper boy to waiter to double glazing salesman to insurance retention advisor in a bank. The list just goes on and on and on. And I've never stuck at anything except this. And I genuinely believe it's because this is the thing I love, you know, and it's that age old saying that, you know, if you find a job that you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And I have to say, you know, the things that I like to fill my time with now, you know, my vocation is as a youth work practitioner. It's amazing that I'm now in the world of karting, because you're surrounded by young girls and boys who are racing and they just want to get a leg up the ladder. They want to work at their craft. But for someone like me to be in that universe who understands the language and the science of teenagers, who kind of wants to help them develop and help them evolve, you end up making incredible bonds with these drivers. You know, you see them playing football at the side of the track in the late evening and you go, oh, I'm coming to join in. And you're just one of them. You're one of the kids. But it's nice because it sort of validates what they're doing. It validates their right to exist and gives them the freedom to move without judgment from the parents. You know, be more professional, be more serious, come on. But you have to remind these kids that they're allowed to be kids. They're allowed to be teenagers, especially in such a high pressure world as motorsport. It's one of the, I would say it's probably the toughest form of sport in the world to do. Well, it's a good question. Why is it the most important? Why is it the toughest? I think it's because when you look at sports like football and tennis and rugby and cricket, there is a sort of accessibility to them. I mean, it's not, it is tough to break into the sport at the top level, but if you have talent, the talent will flow. And it will take you all the way to where you need to go. You can learn the skills and work with people to develop it, and you'll go up the ladder. But to get into football, you turn up to the club, you start kicking around, you listen, you take on the knowledge, and on you go. You don't even need to own your own equipment to do that. You just turn up with, you know, generic sports gear, and you start to put on a show, you put your skills together, and you develop it. With racing, you need to have equipment before you even set foot on the racetrack. You've got to buy your own kart. You've got to buy your own safety gear. And that costs an incredible amount of money. I mean, for a kid to go racing at the bottom level of karting, whether it's Bambinos or Cadets, depending on whether you're age 6 or age 8, I mean, to have all the safety gear, the race suit, the gloves, the boots, the helmet, the correct fireproof underwear, everything that has to be taken into account in terms of safety equipment, sets of tires, fuel, you know, oil, all of the parts, pay a mechanic to help you engineer it. If you don't know anything about the kart yourself, running a race team, if you want to be at the front, you know, you're talking thousands per weekend. And it's an astonishing. And that's why I adore this sport as much as I do. To those people that are on the starting grid, just being there is a victory in and of itself. Just being there is a win, whether you are going to come in first or last. The very fact that you've managed to get the kart onto the starting grid in the first place, that's a victory. You know, that's such an incredible amount of hard work to put into it, perhaps more so than when you look at other sports, because you can just show up and do your best. You can't do that in racing. You've got to do all the hard work first to get the equipment, and it's got to be the right equipment. It's got to be the right gear. You know, you have to make sure it's all correct, and it's so expensive. So just getting the money to get onto the starting grid, it's something I never did. You know, I knew as an 8-year-old, this was the sport I was destined to be good at. I could be good in a racing car because I just got it. I understood it. I understood how to drive one, even watching Formula One at a young age. And I think a lot of racing drivers would agree and feel the same way. If you know it, you know it. And we never had any money, so it was never going to be an option. And so I never thought about it again. I thought about it all the time, but I knew I was never going to do it. So it became a frustration, but it was something I couldn't change. So I didn't really think about the likelihood of ever doing it. But it's so, so difficult. These guys are just absolute warriors. And I'm in awe of all of them, whether they're, you know, in their 60s or if they're only 6. The fact that they're on the grid, that's just such an amazing achievement.
I totally agree, especially the youngins. And it's just nice to see the young ones. It's like the next generation. And when they reach their late teens and compared to the adults, and some of them are like sons or daughters of the previous ones. And you're like, oh, that's so cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the funniest things about it, actually, is when you get there to the circuit and you see a famous racer. And it happens a lot in sort of the karting worlds now, especially when if you're someone like me who's been watching the sport for 30 years, you recognize a driver from your childhood is there at the circuit, and they've got their kid now racing, and it's like, oh my gosh. So I was at an airport midway through 2020. Was it 21? No, it was last year. We were in Belgium and coming back from a race, and I hear my name, and I turn around, and it's Emerson Fittipaldi.
Whoa.
The two-time Formula One world champion. And he's there with his kid and with the family. They've been there watching a race, but they were in the paddock with us the previous year racing, because the youngest one was racing. And, you know, I was a recognized personality for the kid. And that's the thing, you know, when you're dealing with these youngsters, you know, you are making a formation of their youth. A lot of the kids that now go on to IndyCar or Le Mans or Formula One or these sort of amazing sports, they never forget their karting. They never forget the karting roots. It's like being at school with a good teacher. You know, you'll always remember the teachers that informed you, even through, you know, your 20s and 30s and 40s. You'll always remember those teachers that had the big influence on you. And it's the same with karting. You know, the drivers always love going back to their roots. So it's a very privileged position to be in. And, you know, it's very humbling, you know, when I think that, you know, 4 days ago, I'm stood on the circuit at Paul Ricard and I'm chatting with Felipe Massa and Jean Alesi, who have both been Grand Prix winners in Formula One for Ferrari. It's just such an amazing thing. You never would have thought that, you know, some kid on a fairly average street in Catford who's autistic would ever get the chance to mingle with these people. It's just astonishing.
It really is. It's amazing how things just change like that. And I understand when it's like it doesn't feel real, or it's like it doesn't sink in until way afterwards, and you're just like, that just happened, oh my god.
Absolutely.
What would you say to other autistics who aspire to be a commentator or anything along the racing field?
It's a really good question. Nothing is as good as pure passion. The good thing, I guess, about being autistic is that I'm really good with data and with statistics, and things that I have a passion for, they stick in the memory a lot. And I think a lot of autistics who have a passion for sport in particular will be able to recall, you know, games or matches that they watched or races that they've seen with an amazing sort of photographic memory. I can't remember important things like, you know, how much I'm earning on a particular weekend or how much I've got to pay for this particular bill, but I can recall exactly what gear a driver was stuck in during a race in 1994 that robbed them of a championship. It's those kind of things that, you know, we're really good at. Anybody on the ASD spectrum, we're really, really good at sort of, you know, being able to handle that sort of information, and we remember it and we can recall it. Yeah. You know, even from a young age, like sort of 8, 9, I was debating with people 3 or 4 times my age whose fault an accident was during a Grand Prix. And that all comes from passion. It all comes from enthusiasm. I think it's important for autistics to embrace what makes them passionate. And I think a lot of people mistake that for over keenness, and it's not. You know, you should never be afraid of the things you're passionate about. We live in a very accessible community now, thanks to the internet and things like YouTube and Twitch. We have this ability to go out there and create amazing things. Society has, you know, two ways that they can take that. They can either embrace the creativity or they can shun it. And, you know, I'm fascinated by things that I have a passion for. So on the side, I have a passion for Lego. So I like to build lots and lots of different, you know, sort of kits. I'm not one of these people that can create a masterpiece from nothing, but I love sort of collecting and building the kits. And I'm still, like many autistics, I'm still addicted to the sort of the TV shows and the movies that I grew up with. So the Gerry Anderson series are still massive to me. Things like Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet and Stingray and Joe 90. And I still love indulging in these sorts of things. The interesting one, I don't know whether it's all autistics, but certainly a lot of autistics I've spoken to, the Island of Sodor, the world of Thomas the Tank Engine, and sort of the world of Disney Pixar Cars and things like that. It's funny, the sort of the anthropomorphic nature of machines having characteristics. So a lot of these sort of television shows and sort of cartoons and whatever, where machines have personalities, somehow that really gels with the autistic personality. I've been watching a lot of incredible content on YouTube and various other sort of mediums where people have made this their life's work. And it's like, do you know what? I totally get it. I totally get that sort of that affinity. Like Francis Bourgeois, what an amazing creator. Francis Bourgeois, the Trainspotter. who's, you know, made such a massive deal of it on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube. I mean, the guy is just such an inspiration to my own personal creativity. I'm still stuck in this age-old 90s, 2000s rut of what a television presenter should look like, what a commentator is supposed to be. And I so need to tap into my own personality. You know, I need to kind of break out of this rigid box. And certainly for the first 5 years, I was stuck in this idea of what a motor racing commentator is supposed to be, what a sports commentator should behave like. And it's only in the last sort of 5 years that I've gone, no, that's not you. That's not who you are. You need to bring your own sense of energy, your own sense of skill, your own sense of agenda to it. And it's only in the last sort of 5 years that I've actually been at my best.
Yeah.
So I would say to people, you know, if you're going to do this job, then you cannot come at it from anything other than pure passion, but also pure love of what you're doing and how you're doing it. You have to be able to embrace your own unique style of doing it, because nobody can give you that. You have to be true to your own personality. And that's quite difficult for an autistic. We have a sort of an idea of how things are, the way we perceive it. But we need to learn not to be frightened of the things that make us who we are. I totally recommend Callum Knight and his fantastic book, The Secrets of My Spectrum. It's a really good look into how people have, you know, it's the difference, I guess, between perceptions and experience of how people perceive people with autism and how they're able to, you know, channel that into their own lifestyle. So it's definitely worth a read. Callum really has a good perspective on it. And actually, I don't read a lot of these sort of books, but it was the kind of thing that, you know, I needed to read that at the right time. But yeah, in terms of people on the autistic spectrum wanting to become sports commentators and television presenters, there's no substitute for passion. And people who have raw passion in everything that they do are just untamable. They can't be stopped. You know, you will rise up the ladder if you have that ability. I'm still going through that ladder, and I'm going through it in a very unconventional way. I don't have an agent. I don't have somebody steering the ship. I'm doing it all on my own and just waiting for the phone to ring or nudging people with emails and whatever. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But the one thing that I don't do now that I certainly did at the start was shy away from who I am. And I'm very, very keen to show people, you know, you can have any commentator or presenter that you want, but you're only going to get one Jake Sanson. This is who I am. This is kind of what you're going to be able to deal with. If you want passion, if you want fun, if you want energy, if you want everybody in the paddock to sort of get that infectious disease of enjoyment and enthusiasm and charisma, then that's what I can give.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely have noticed, and know your more recent examples of your work, that you are shining through a lot more, and it's just fantastic to see. I absolutely enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, especially sort of the last 2-3 years, I think COVID actually taught me a lot about myself, because when you've got nothing to do, you have to figure out what you're going to do with the rest of that day, what the rest of that week, the rest of that month. You've got to figure out, what are you going to do? And I did a lot of internal introspection. I figured out what it is that makes me good, what it is that makes me bad, and tried to work on it. And it's not a complete process yet. I haven't finished. And I think I quite like that. I quite like the, you know, at the moment, I'm still about maybe 65, 70% of the complete package that I can be to be world-class. What I do have, which is an advantage now, having done a Formula One race, is that I don't have to ask myself, am I good enough to be at the top? And that's one of the things I think a lot of people struggle with. It's self-affirmation. It's, you know, am I good enough to do this? Am I good enough to be this, this, that, or the other? I'm very fortunate in the sense that I never have to ask myself that question now, because I clearly am, because otherwise I wouldn't have had that request, that opportunity.
Yeah.
So now it's a case of what's going to keep me happy, what's going to keep me active, what's going to keep me in work. And I think it's just surrounding myself with people who get that same vibe, that same buzz. And, you know, as long as I get that feeling of being allowed to be myself whilst also paying my bills, then there's nothing to stop me from being who I am.
Definitely. Before we finish up, where can we find you on social media?
So on Twitter, I am at Jake Sanson. And then on Facebook and Instagram, I'm on at Jake Sanson Official. And starting from early 2023, you're also going to find me on YouTube and Twitch. And my channel is going to be called at Jake Sanson Online, which I think is one of the better witty puns I've come up with. keep an eye out for Jake Stance online. And that's where you'll be able to find me doing all sorts of mad things. It won't just be to do with racing cars. So if that doesn't float your boat, there's going to be a lot of things to do with Lego. There's going to be a lot of things to do with movies and various music and bits and pieces. So there's a lot of stuff that's going to come.
That's awesome. Well, Jake, it was great talking to you in the Othish podcast.
Thank you. It's been an honour to be on. Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you for listening to the Othish podcast. If you like more accessibility, feel free to read the transcripts at othish.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for listening. This is Unikage from Othish, signing out.